biological, chemical, and radioactive fallout, developed by Wayne LeBaron, a health physicist who has served as a specialist in environmental health, communicable diseases, and has worked as a nuclear specialist for the U.S. government, gives you easy-to-follow video instructions and walks you step-by-step through the process of preparing your home as a shelter. Get this critical video every American needs for only $29 plus shipping. Order by calling New Millennium today at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Or order on the web at BerkeyWater.com.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of a fascinating gentleman. His name is Jeff Charlotte, and he's written a book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Very Heart of American Power. Now, certainly most people have never heard of the family or the foundation, but it's been there. We've been looking at it for a long period of time, knowing some people that are in the organization and being very, very suspicious of it. But, of course, we had no way means of getting more information than that's available on the Internet until Jeff wrote this fascinating book about an invisible organization that claims to be Christian fundamentalist that is interested in taking over power and controlling not only America, but it's a worldwide organization of people who seem to be involved in this secret group which seems to have unlimited funds and unlimited power at every aspect of our society. Jeff, this is a fascinating book. How did you happen to learn about the family?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Thanks for having me on the show. I've learned about the family. I've been writing about religion for many years. And some years ago, I was writing a book about unusual religious communities around the United States of all sorts. It was not a political book at all. And while I was researching that, a friend of mine, a Christian conservative friend, and was worried that a brother had joined a cult. And since she knew I wrote a lot about religion, she said, would you take my brother, McCall Zeke, in the book out to dinner and talk to him and see what he's gotten involved in? This guy had left a good career in finance and his fiancée to move in with this group called The Family, this international network of, I guess we can get into what we want to call them. It's sort of hard to describe. So I met with a guy, and he said, you know, you really got to see this group yourself. And that's the only way you get in. It's by recommendation. And he knew who I was, but I think he was convinced that once I saw it, I would be just so impressed by the great work they were doing that I would want to become a part of it. And instead, I was horrified by a group that regularly invokes Hitler as a leadership model, and that's not something I want to be a part of.
Well, of course, what's interesting, of course, is that many of our key political leaders are part of it or been a part of it in the past. They have apparently a home there in Washington, D.C., where a lot of our congressmen actually live full-time when they're in Congress, and then they go to this house that, you know, and they have some of the most powerful people in the world there. They put on the annual prayer breakfast. Most people think that's put on by, you know, the government or the president or something. It's not. So give us a little of the background, because these people seem to be like an octopus with tentacles into every aspect of power and within the Christian evangelical movement.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I hesitated a moment before on how to describe them. The inner circle, in fact, rejects the label Christian, so I don't use that. They say they're not Christians.
I don't think they are, but go ahead.
No, I don't think they are either. I mean, in fact, this goes back, you know, the group goes back to 70 years ago. And in the mid-1930s, the founder, a man named Abraham Baraity, experienced what he thought was a new revelation from God. He thought on one night, April 1935, He's lying in bed. He's thinking about the world and, you know, the Great Depression and the state of affairs. And God, he thinks, comes down and tells him, Verity, Christianity has gotten it wrong for 2,000 years. Because Christianity, of course, concerns itself with the poor, the suffering, the weak, the down and out. Those were whom, you know, that's whom Jesus loved. And he says, that's all wrong, Verity. He says, what I care about are not the down and out, but the up and out. That's the word, that's the phrase Verity used for those who are already powerful. And it became a gospel of power for the already powerful. And of course, this goes along at the same time. Verity was concluding that democracy had run its course, that democracy was over, democracy couldn't compete with fascism, which he admired, and communism, which he didn't, but he thought was still stronger than democracy. And so he created this.
Hold that thought, yes. Right there, Jeff, please.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this afternoon is Jeff Charlotte. He's written a fascinating book called The Family. And Jeff, of course, we brought a new station, a couple of new stations on board here, so I'm just going to repeat what Jeff has said. There is a secret group. It is an invisible group. One of the most powerful groups in America, and you've never heard of it. We've actually been doing some research on this in the past, but only been able to glean a certain amount of information on it. Jeff has done a tremendous job writing a book called The Family, because he actually lived there for a while, and then, of course, he had the opportunity of going through their papers, which probably nobody had ever gone through, to launder them, because there's some terribly incriminating things there. This is a group that's so powerful, it's been able to conceal its very existence. It has people at the highest levels of our government and the political process. But not only that, but it infiltrates the church. And it intends to be invisible. And, of course, it's the product of a gentleman who some 70 years ago during the Great Depression had a revelation from God. And he actually said that Christianity had failed. This was going to be a new form of Christianity, but it was going to have to do with power. It was. Would that be a fair statement? Jeff, it's all about power.
Exactly. You know, that's what they read the New Testament, and unlike most of us who read it and see a message of love and mercy and justice, the common denominator they see in all of Christ's teachings is power. That's what they take away, and that's why they admired fascism. And the successor to the founding man named Doug Coe, who leads it to this day, will say in his sermons over and over again, you can find these online, that Hitler and Stalin and Mao are the models, not because he admired their ends. He says, look, these are evil men, of course. But he admired their methods, which most of us are not too fond of either. And what he meant by that, he said that what the gospel teaches us is a gospel of total obedience and total authoritarianism. Totalitarianism is what he's really talking about. And so you combine that with this idea that God is only concerned with elites, top men, key men, as they call them, and that they would organize these key men. And they would say, no, the key men will help you and me, Dr. Stan. They'll help the rest of us, you know, out of the goodness, out of their heart. But the power must reside with them. So this amounts to a kind of trickle-down religion. And I think a lot of your listeners out there are going to say, that doesn't sound like Christianity to me. And not to me either, and that's why I hesitate to call them Christian. Although a number of evangelicals over the years have gotten involved with the group, and they've been very influential with...
Hold that thought. For just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Jeff is talking about how really this purpose of the family is power. It's all about power. It's all about going to an elite and creating an elite and influencing an elite. And of course, you know, instead of wanting to help the poor and the downtrodden and the Christian message that most of us get from the Bible, they read the Bible, and the Bible tells them that the ultimate goal is power. And the God that they worship, and they do worship a God, seems to be an entirely different God than the God that the traditional Christian evangelicals or fundamentalists like myself would worship at all. They seem to have a different goal, a different perspective. So you pick the story up because it's a fascinating, fascinating book.
Well, and what they've been able to do is they've been able to insinuate themselves right into the heart of American power. And the subtitle of the book is The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And you know, I say that, I use that with respect, actually, for a lot of people who are fundamentalists. In the book, I make a distinction. there's what I call popular or populist fundamentalism. That's all the folks out there who might describe themselves with that term or be described with that term. And then there's this group, and they call themselves an avant-garde. They call themselves an elite. And they're only interested in converting the elites. One of the ways that they do that is in 1953, they created something called the National Prayer Breakfast, which is held every year to this day. It's held in the Washington Hilton. The United States President always addresses it. Most of Congress goes. If you're invited to the National Prayer Breakfast, your invitation will come on congressional letterhead. If you're a reporter like me, you RSVP to the White House press office. So naturally, you think it's probably this is an official government event. It's not at all. It's entirely private, privately funded, privately organized, privately owned event of the family. And, you know, some years ago, every now and then, a problem comes up with it. When you see the international guest list of the National Prayer Breakfast, you go down the list, especially the smaller countries, they send a delegation. As often as not, that delegation is headed up by that country's Minister of Defense. And they're not there to pray. They're there to get handouts from the U.S. government. Taiwan, some years ago, an intrepid reporter noticed that the Taiwanese government was giving money to the National Prayer Breakfast Organization. He says, why are you doing this in the press? And the Taiwanese government had a ready answer. Says, look, you know, for a $10,000 gift, we can get FaceTime with the President of the United States. That's the best deal, and that's the best deal in the foreign affairs going. It is not, however, the most democratic deal. It's an end run around the State Department, as one government official calls it.
Now, of course, the key figure in this is Brother Douglas Cole, and most people have never heard of him, but he is the he seems to be the organizer of this. He seems to be the key figure. He worked silently behind the scenes, and most Christians have never heard of Douglas Cole.
Yeah, some years ago, actually, back in 2004, Time magazine wanted to make a list of the 25 most powerful evangelicals in America, and they called me up. I write a lot about this stuff. They called me up, and after my suggestion, I said, Doug Coe. The reporter had never heard of Doug Coe, and I said, look, call a dozen congressmen. If less than half of them don't say, you know, get half of them, at least half of them will say Doug Coe was one of the power brokers in Washington. And if they don't say that, don't include him on the list. And, of course, he makes the list. I think he was something like number four on the list. He was called the stealth persuader, a man who has advised every president since Nixon. His friends call him the shadow Billy Graham, which raises the question, well, why does Billy Graham need a shadow? And here's Doug Coe speaking about his own role. This is Doug Coe in a sermon that's available online at the website of the Navigators, the Christian organization. He's talking about the family. Because it functions invisibly like the mafia. They keep their organization invisible. Everything visible is transitory. Everything invisible is permanent and lasts forever. The more you can make your organization invisible, the more influence it will have. That may be true, but it also the less democratic, the less small d democratic, and really, frankly, the less American and the less Christian it will be. This is not a Christian organization in any real sense of the word. And, you know, you can argue that it's a very anti-American organization, too, because it's anti-democracy, and that's what we're about here.
Oh, of course, one of the interesting things is, of course, it really operates through small cells, and probably the reason that they actually admire Stalin and Chairman Mao and Hitler is because they always had a small elite group that was really in control. Of course, most people didn't understand that. They thought it was a mass movement, but it never was. It was always a very small, elite, well-financed group, which is exactly what the family is, and most Christians have never heard of this invisible group. That term you use, I think, is so apropos for them.
Yeah. I mean, you make a very good point there. You know, the family has sometimes referred to itself as an avant-garde of fundamentalism. And they don't mean avant-garde in any artistic sense. They mean it in the Leninist sense. Lenin also spoke of an avant-garde, the idea that a revolutionary cadre, you know, a few people could change a whole country. And Doug Coe in his sermons often refers back to the Bolshevik Revolution as an example of what is possible and something to be emulated. He also refers to Mao and the Red Guard as an example of something to be emulated. He's not a communist, anything but he admires the strength and power that those organizations had. And so the family, going back to 1935, decided to organize not through churches or not through mass rallies or not anything in the public square where we could look at it and, you know, agree or disagree as we saw fit, but through private cells. The original insight of one of the founders, he said, well, you know, this is going to be the age of minority control, and if we can organize congressmen into cells, we'll be able to achieve things there that we would never be able to do legislatively. And again, that may be true, but that's not what we elect our congressmen for.
And I think this term cell, you know, the Communist Party always had cells, but they actually used the term for their group in
yeah,
the family.
Yeah,
they refer to cells.
The term. I spent, you know, I went and I lived with a group for about a month, and then I left, and I was so stunned by what I'd encountered that I said, well, I want to learn more about the history of the group. How can I do that? And I was incredibly lucky. I discovered that they had dumped 600 boxes of documents, literally hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of documents, in the archive of the Billy Graham Center archive at Wheaton College in Illinois. And at the time, the archive was open to anybody. They since restricted it in response to my research. But you can still look at a lot of it. And I went and really, all told, spent years going through these documents. And one of the things I was surprised was their use of the term cell going back to the 1940s. And they're very clear that they are taking the term from communism and that they're organizing themselves along the same lines as communism, but toward ends which are more sympathetic to fascism. And I don't use that term lightly. The family, in fact, after World War II, was instrumental in whitewashing the records of numerous former Nazis, including some Nazi spies who had been deported from the United States before the war, and they show up after the war advising U.S. congressmen. So when I use the term fascism, I'm talking about the real deal.
And, of course, this is so hard for people to believe that there could really be a group out there that would have tentacles into really almost the entire aspect of the Christian religion here in the United States, and nobody would ever hear of it. And, you know, of course, I belong to Christian organizations all across America. It's only indirectly I was able to get little glimpses of this. But where does the money come from? It seems like they have endless money. They've got all sorts of homes and groups and mansions. And, I mean, it's almost like they have unlimited funds as well.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there are, if you ask the leader of the group, Doug Coe, if there's anything, he'll say, oh, there's no group at all, just a network of friends. And this past spring, NBC Nightly News did a little segment on the group and on my book and so on. And they tried that. They said, look, you know, we're going to do a segment on your group. And the family said, oh, but there's no group at all. We're just a group of friends.
Right.
And NBC News responded, well, we've been reviewing your tax records. So, you know, most friends don't have 501c3 organizations. So there are tax records, but even those are incomplete. So, for instance, on their various foundations, if you put them together, it maybe adds up to something like $30 million a year, which isn't very much for a big organization. But on the other hand, that's not how the money moves. And they're within the group, they're quite open in the documents, that money should move according to what they call the Mann method. So that means, Dr. Stan, if I wanted to support Radio Liberty, I wouldn't make a donation to your station or invest in the station, you know, so where money's on the books. I would make a private gift, which is, in other words, an off-the-book gift. Their mansion in Washington is called the Cedars in Arlington. And, you know, I was able to find the documents about how they bought it. They bought it with donations from various corporate executives. So, for instance, the CEO of Raytheon, the missile manufacturer, gave them a big chunk of change. Ken Olson, the CEO of Digital Computers, gave them a big chunk of change. This money goes in, and these are personal gifts, and so it doesn't show up. Even Doug Coe, the leader of the group, he makes no salary. Some years his income ranges from $90,000, which is, you know, not a bad wage, but hardly proportioned to what he's doing. And some years he'll only have $12,000, and yet every year he lives very, very well. And that's because the money is being given as a gift and off the books. And, you know, when you organize your money like that, yeah, you really can. You can do pretty much whatever you want.
And, of course, the thing is that they have friends in very, very powerful places, you know, not only within government, but certainly within industry. And this is really what's so interesting. And the people get into the organization, and then they're sort of, many of them are in it all the rest of their lives, but you know, they may not attend meetings regularly, but they're there working in the background to help it further its goals. But what is its ultimate goal? What does it want to do as far as America? What does it want to do as far as the world is concerned?
Well, I mean, they'll say in their documents, they'll say, look, our long-term goal is 200 world leaders bound together in the family under God. And that's sort of a vague goal. And I think the more relevant question to look at the group and, you know, recognizing that really what they're worshiping here is power, is to ask ourselves, not is it what they want to do, but ask ourselves rather, what have they done? And I think their ultimate goal is the preservation of power. They take a biblical verse, Romans 13, verse 1, very literally, the powers that be are ordained of God. Now, most of us see that as Paul talking in some ways about spiritual affairs, but they see that as a justification for their own power. The goal is the preservation of that power, and at any cost. So you look around the world, and if you see a world that you think everything is hunky-dory, then you've got no problem with the family. But if you have questions about how American democracy is working, about our access to our representatives, about the way our economy is organized, then I think you have a very serious issue.
And I think many people realize it doesn't matter whether we have the Democrats or Republicans in, the same programs continue.
Exactly.
And part of that is the influence of the family. Well, you know, one of the most fascinating parts of your book was your discussion of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly Hillary Clinton is the last person I would expect to be involved with a group of people who refer to themselves as fundamentalist Christians, although we might question that. But certainly, apparently, she goes and she prays with them. And what's this all about?
Well, Hillary Clinton, and, you know, when I was living with a family, they referred to her as a friend. And that's a semi-formal designation. That's just not, you know, like, you're my pal. You can be a member, you can be a friend, or you can be everybody else. And Hillary was a friend, and I didn't really think too much of it until a few years later I was reporting on Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, who is a member of the family. And hanging around with Sam Brownback, who's very conservative, I kept on hearing about Hillary Clinton, and I was sort of surprised. And people were speaking very positively of her. And they were saying, look, you know, not that we're ever going to vote for Hillary, but we feel much more comfortable with her because we know she's getting spiritual counseling from Doug Coe. So I looked into it, and in fact, in her memoir, Living History, she writes fairly openly about it. She calls Doug Coe, this leader who's going on about the leadership lessons of Hitler and Mao and so on, a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. She talks about how in 1993, when she came to Washington, she asked Doug Coe to organize a prayer cell for her, and he did. The women involved, it was a sex-segregated prayer cell. Susan Baker, who was the wife of Jim Baker, the Bush Secretary of State. Joanne Kemp, who was the wife of Jack Kemp, and the wives of several conservative Democrats. And conservative is not really the best word. Democrats were invested in the same model of power, let's say. Senator Bill Nelson's wife, Representative Tony Hall's wife. So she had this long-standing connection, and yeah, we ask ourselves, these people are calling themselves fundamentalist Christians, what's the connection? The common denominator for them is power. They want access to power, and one of the things that's allowed the family to endure for 70 years is they never tied themselves too closely to one political party, because ultimately they're not particularly committed to any values. They're committed to power, so they want a hand on both sides of the aisle.
And I really think the fact that Hillary would be considered a friend of the organization, and basically you have the people who are members of the organization. What's the difference between a member and a brother?
Well, a member, Hillary is a friend, and that means that she was somewhat heavily involved. I mean, for years she's been, meeting with a prayer cell and so on. A member is someone who goes beyond that, who not just is part of a prayer cell, as many congressmen are, but might do something. For instance, Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma is referred to as a member. And one of the things Inhofe has done is travel around Africa on behalf of the family, making contact with foreign leaders. And the thing we really have to remember is, you know, Jim Inhofe, how many of your listeners even know who he is? He's one senator among 100. But in a small African nation, a U.S. senator is a representative of the most powerful nation on earth. So one senator will be received by the prime minister or the president or whoever is in charge in that country. And if that man goes there and says, look, I don't want to talk about trade. I don't want to talk about foreign affairs. I want to talk about Jesus. Well, that government is going to hear that as official U.S. foreign policy. And then some U.S. senators are probably out there saying, well, that's fine. I want to talk about Jesus. We got to remember, what kind of Jesus are they talking about? It's not a Jesus you or I would recognize, Dr. Stan.
Well, I really fear that you're absolutely right, and I think that's what the really strange thing about this is, what God are they really worshiping? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jeff was just talking about the fact that one of the most unlikely people you've ever heard of is known as a friend of the family. And that, of course, is Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, of course, has been in contact with him. They actually arranged a cell to pray with her on a regular basis. And Jeff comments that if you go and you read Hillary's book, she will comment on Doug Coe, of course, who's the head of this organization, has been since 1969. And of course, you have to ask yourself, what sort of an organization would align itself with Hillary Clinton? And I think the answer is one that is interested in power. It has nothing to do with what Hillary believes. It has nothing to do with what the Democrats or Republican believes. It's all about power. Well, Jeff, what are they trying to accomplish throughout the world? Because this is not simply isolated to the United States, is it?
Yeah, you know, you ask, you know, one that's about power, and I think that's a really good way of putting it. In the book, I have a chapter in which I pair Senator Sam Brownback and Senator Clinton as a member and a friend, you know, on both sides of the aisle. Brownback, ironically, gave me tremendous access, and Clinton did not. Both are invested in this. You have to say, well, what do Sam Brownback and Hillary Clinton have in common? They have in common power, right? What is this group then trying to achieve? And I think a good way of putting it, a friend of mine, a church historian, was looking at it. He said, you know, this group is not really left-wing, and they're really not left-wing, but they're not exactly right-wing either. What they really are is empire-wing. And I think when we look at American history, there's two visions of what America can be. There's the great democratic vision, and again, small d, democratic, nothing to do with the parties, a vision that's shared by conservatives and liberals alike, those who think that America's a great democracy. And then there's the empire vision, those who want America to be an empire kind of like Rome. And that's where the family comes in. That's been their connection. Over their history, I'll give you one example. When they first really started moving overseas into developing nations, they'd already recruited a lot of former Nazis. They were quite strong in Europe after the war. 1959, two members of the family, Senator Frank Carlson and Senator Homer Capehart, both on the Foreign Affairs Committee, led a family junket, a family trip to Haiti.
Well, when you speak of family, you're not talking about their family. You're talking about
that family. Yeah, back then it was called International Christian Leadership. They led this trip to Haiti, and they were there to interview a man named Papadoc Duvalier. Some of your listeners may know as one of the most brutal dictators in the Western Hemisphere of the 20th century. And they wanted to know, should the United States support Papadoc Duvalier, the dictator of Haiti? Was he the kind of guy we wanted to be involved with? And they came back and they announced to their comrades on the Senate floor, their colleagues, and they said, Papa Doc is a man of God. Well, this was a strange assessment for a dictator, an anti-democratic dictator, who was so far from being a man of God and so deluded, he actually thought he was God. He told his people that he was God. Not he was a man of God, he was God. But they said he's a man of God, and U.S. support, unfortunately, funneled into his regime, and he used it to create something called the Tantan Makuts. Some listeners may have heard of this, which is the voodoo-inspired death squads in Haiti. Really brutal regime. This is the kind of government they're supporting. And these examples go on and on. In the book, I tell the story of their involvement with the dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, who, again, they decided was a man of God. Suharto was a Muslim, but he was willing to bow down to their very particular version of Jesus in exchange for access to U.S. congressmen and U.S. oil executives. Siad Barre, the dictator of Somalia, who they arranged to have his defense budget doubled, and he used it to commit a sort of genocidal attack on his own people. These are the kind of guys they're supporting. There's nothing remotely Christian, by any definition of the word, left or right, about what they were doing. But they were able to do this in pursuit of this idea of American foreign relations, which is imperial, not democratic. Now, we have to go out, and as America, we sometimes have to deal with unsavory characters, but let's do so on honest terms. And I think that we've learned time and time again that when we make deals with bullies, as we did with Saddam Hussein in the 80s, it's going to come back and it's going to hurt us. And unfortunately, the family sees that as the vision of America that they want to pursue.
Yeah, and of course, the thing is, of course, they have their people. Many of their people are congressmen. Many of them are senators. Sometimes they'll be affiliated with the, you know, and the cabinets. But of course, they all have this allegiance to this secret group. And the fact that this has remained so secret, I do not believe that it could have remained a secret without a little help from, you know, some of the major media outlets. And I'm really pleased that HarperCollins was willing to publish your book. I think, of course, it gives access to the mainstream. And the message, I think, is so important that this group could exist and nobody ever would ever heard of it.
Well, I would love to address that, Dr. Singh, because I think the media history of the group is very interesting, and I think it's something that Christians, and especially fundamentalist Christians, should concern themselves with. Part of what that
hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and Seth, go right ahead with the point you were about to make before you were so rudely interrupted.
Oh, no problem at all. I want to address the question of why hasn't been more media attention to the group. And I should say there has been some. The Los Angeles Times did a one-year investigation into the group in 2002. They put a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Lisa Getter, on the case. She came back with an explosive story, noting that the family, in fact, had been connecting, and they'd been representing Central American death squad leaders to the U.S. government. Really, really explosive stuff. No follow-up, no media follow-up at all. And in fact, this spring, as I mentioned, NBC Nightly News did a segment on the book. They thought they had a big scoop. They were reporting on Hillary Clinton's association. They thought, boy, we have found one of the stories of the campaign cycle. NBC Nightly News, this is pretty mainstream. Andrea Mitchell is up there talking about it, and Brian Williams and so on. No follow-up. Well, there's no conspiracy here. There's something worse. It's called conventional wisdom. And that is what has prevented the media from really digging into this thing. And, you know, what that has to do with is, you know, and I'm part of the mainstream media, and I'm probably a lot more liberal than a lot of your listeners. And so I can say honestly, when people say the media is liberal, it is. That's absolutely true. And it has a lot of stereotypes about religion. They tend to think of, if you say fundamentalist, they think of someone like Jerry Falwell, you know, a southern man who's up there at his pulpit and banging his pulpit and maybe a little overweight, and, you know, they have a stereotype of fundamentalism. Well, that's not Doug Coe. Doug Coe is not an outsider trying to get in. He's a smooth operator. He's an insider in Washington. He doesn't look like what they think a fundamentalist should look like, and therefore they ignore him. The family has pursued that with, you know, they know what they're doing. When they organize a national prayer breakfast, for instance, they tend to invite non-Christian speakers. They had Prince Bandar, the longtime ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States, come and address the group one year. And so, you know, people are saying, well, how is this going to be a fundamentalist group if they've got this Prince Bandar from this Muslim dictatorship coming and talking? And it's a smart move. At the same time, they recognize that the prayer breakfast, as Doug Coe himself says, is only 0.1% of what we really do. And what they really do is this behind-the-scenes work.
And, of course, I think the most amazing thing, I had always thought this was a presidential prayer breakfast because, you know, you got your invitations from the president's press office. But, of course, everything is, of course, illusion, and everything is to cover up the fact that there's an organization working behind the presidency and behind our duly elected representatives, a secret organization professing to be Christian, but, of course, really after power. And that is, of course, the incredible, incredible part of this story. We're going to be back in just a moment with Jeff Charlotte on The Family. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Jeff has done an amazing job, and he had actually spent, what was it, a year or 7 years going through all of these papers back there?
6 years, a total of 6 years of research went into this book. And, you know, I think that has something to do with why the media missed this as well, which is, you know, this is not a story you can tell quickly. This is not a sensational story. You get into the book, you know, this is a historical story. I decided, you know, for my readers, I knew a lot of my readers were going to be secular readers. I knew a lot of my readers were going to be people who weren't familiar with American religious history, so I wanted to give them some context. So I write in the book also about Jonathan Edwards and Charles Finney and the whole history of the religious revival in America. Billy Sunday, these characters, not to say that they're the same thing as the family, but to contextualize it, to say, look, here is what American Christianity is, American religion is, and then here's this other strange thing, this network of elite avant-garde power worship represented by the family. So that's the story of how the book came about and why it took so long.
Well, it almost seems, you know, these young men all getting together, living together, working together, you know, spending their time, you know, going out cleaning toilets, raking leaves. I mean, these are the elite, many of the young elite people of our country. They're looking for purpose in life, and of course they find it here in this sort of invisible brotherhood. And it almost sounds very much to me like a cult, something like the Moonies. What would you think about that?
Well, you're referring to chapter one of the book, right. Called Ivanwald, after the name of the house that I moved in. The beginning of this story, of the book, the family, begins with this month that I spent living with this house for young men who were being sort of groomed for leadership in the group. And there was a group of about 15 young men who lived in a house just up the street from the headquarters of the group called the Cedars in Arlington, Virginia. And, they would just spend time, and there wasn't really even... I thought this was going to be a very Christian group. That's what had been described to me as. There wasn't a whole lot of Bible study. Very few of the men had a whole Bible. Most of them, you know, carried one of those little editions with the New Testament and Psalms and Proverbs. And they didn't really know much about that either, because what they were really studying was not Bible, wasn't Scripture. It was networking. It was influence. It was access. It was power. If you stuck around for long enough, you'd be assigned a mentor who would be a congressman or an ambassador or some kind of business executive. And if you left, you might run into some trouble. And, you know, I encountered this when I decided, you know, I'd seen enough of this and I wanted to get out of this. At the time, my sister was having her first child, and it was a difficult birth. And I wanted to go. She'd had the child. I wanted to go see the child. I said, look, guys, I'm leaving. And one of the senior brothers in the family, a man named Steve South, who was former counsel to former Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma, says, well, Jeff, you know, sometimes in order to love Jesus, you have to hate your family. Well, you know, that wasn't not any Jesus that I know. And I said, that's it. I'm getting out of here. Another young man, younger guy, had been sent there through the influence of Steve Largent, former representative Steve Largent. Some may remember as a great football player. Great football player, not so good on theology. And had gotten this young guy involved. And, you know, the family was good for the young guy. He'd been kind of a wild kid, and it gave him some sense of responsibility. He wanted to go back in the world and, you know, move on with his career and so on. He said he was ready to go out. And the family said, no, you're not going. And if you do go, we've spoken to your real-world family, your parents and so on. They will never speak to you again. They'll disown you. So this is kind of cultish.
Yes, it really is.
It really is kind of cultish. And there's an evangelical scholar at Westmont College, which is right near you, I think, out there in
Southern California, right.
And where Dr. Ron Enroth, an evangelical scholar, he calls it spiritual abuse. And I think that's a good phrase for it.
Well, I was really interested that Pat Robertson's father had been part of this group. Now, of course, Pat Robertson is certainly one of the most influential Christians in America today because of his association with, Christian broadcasting. And of course, a lot of Christians watch his programs. Sometimes they're really great. And yet, sometimes at key times when he really could take a position, you know, and help preserve the integrity of our country. And, of course, you point out that these people are all about globalism. In other words, not necessarily America, they're about globalism, about this whole idea of the world.
This is a theology of globalization, is what it is. This is the economic process of globalization religionized, and that's not Pat Robertson. And, you know, in the Robertson family, you see the whole story in some ways of the contrast between elite and populist fundamentalism. Robertson's father, Senator Absalom Willis Robertson, a very conservative Democrat from Virginia, was a Dixiecrat. That's the term that they used to use for Democrats who were segregationists. His father was a racist, and was a vice president of the organization. And when young Pat Robertson's coming up and going off to Yale Law School and so on, the family thought he seemed like a very positive prospect. But Pat Robertson, whatever one thinks of him, whether you like him or not, one thing you have to say about him is that he is a guy who is interested in the people. He's a populist. And they did not like that at all. And today, They maintain relationships with Pat Robertson, but he's not their kind of guy. They think he's tacky, they don't like what he does, and frankly, they don't care about whether or not you or I, Dr. Stan, are Christian. It doesn't matter whether the masses are Christian. They only care about the elites.
And, of course, really, they want to get their people into key positions. You commented that some of the young men who go into the family really go into that for the contacts, with the idea that they'll be able to move up the political ladder and one day become congressmen or senators themselves.
Yeah, one of the most amazing things when I was living with a family at this house, Ivanwald, and the story I tell in the first chapter, a lot of the brothers were international. So, for instance, there was a young Norwegian political aide who'd been sent by his government as sort of a liaison. There was two young lawyers from the African nation of Benin who'd been sent there by their president to sort of make contact with this group. But then there was also other young men. There was one guy in his mid-20s from the Czech Republic. His father was a major businessman in the Czech Republic, had been an official in the former communist government, and then was involved in the post-communist government, and sent his son to spend a year at Ivanwald making connections with this group, using this network, and didn't even tell his son that there was, I mean, the group isn't Christian, as we said, but they have this Christian veneer. He didn't know that there was anything Christian about it. This young man comes there, and they say, okay, now we're going to look at our Bibles. And he says, we're going to look at our Bibles? What for? I thought this was about finance, making money. And of course, it is. It is. There is a sort of element of cronyism all around the edges of the group. You see from that example that at its heart, in fact, is not Scripture, not the Bible, but this networking. Whereas one of the leaders of the group, David Coe, the son of Doug Coe, the patriarch of the group, says, when you leave here, when you leave Ivanwald, this place where we are all living, he says, you're going to know the people who rule the world. And that's going to help you rule the world.
You're going to know the people who rule the world, and this will help you rule the world. This is really what it's all about, then.
Yeah, power. Power. Not spreading the gospel. It's not about evangelism. They don't really care about evangelism. It's not about any of the good stuff of the Bible, love or forgiveness. The word justice is interesting. It's such an important word in both the Christian and the Jewish tradition. I, spent 6 years looking through their papers. I've looked at hundreds of thousands of documents. The word justice never appears. There's no concern for justice. So, for instance, when they support the dictator Suharto, who by conservative estimates killed 500,000 of his own people, he called them communists, but what he meant by communists were his political enemies, and he would, for instance, destroy an entire village, kill everybody, old men, women, children, infants. He killed everybody. He was a genocidal lunatic. Now, the family doesn't endorse that. They're not in favor of that, but they just don't care about it. And one of the really startling things that I encountered when I was living with them is that they don't care about morality. Morality, they say, is a prideful concept. Morality is something to keep, the little people, you and I, Dr. Stan, that's something to help us stay in line. But if you're one of God's chosen, you don't need morality. David Coe, one of the leaders of the group, illustrating this point, said to a young man, and I tell this story in the first chapter of the book. He says, Bo, suppose I heard that you had raped 3 little girls. What would I think of you? And this young guy, being a decent human being, says, you would think I was awful. Coe says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. This is such a grotesque distortion of the idea of chosenness, a grotesque mockery of anything Christian or biblical or scriptural at all.
And I think this is really what is so frightening about that is we have people who have a different worldview. Their view is not American, it's globalist. Their view is not democratic, it's power. And, of course, they have their people not planted here, not only here, but throughout the world. And you see, there are about 20,000 people affiliated with this little organization throughout the world.
That was an estimate made by Chuck Colson. Some of your listeners may know Chuck Colson. He's become a very prominent Christian conservative commenter. In his book, Born Again, he talks about he was converted through Doug Coe and through the family. And he describes, in fact, coming to, some version of Christ and declaring his allegiance to the family. And he writes in his book, Born Again, he says, the very next day, I got calls from people all over Washington, including Democrats, people who had been my enemies before, and they vowed to help me. They vowed to help him stay out of jail. Remember, he was involved in Watergate. He did end up serving 7 months, which is a very light sentence for a felony. He called this group, he says, it's a veritable underground of God's men all throughout Washington. And he estimated the worldwide membership at 20,000, which is actually quite small, and they want it to be small. Again, they're only interested in this revolutionary cadre, this elite. As the years went on, Colson ended up breaking with the family, and I'll give Colson credit for this much. He takes his theology seriously, and though I disagree with him on many, many, many things, he is serious about reading his Bible.
And, of course, they don't really stress reading the Bible that way, do they?
I wanted to have a conversation with Senator Sam Brownback, who's a member, and I wanted to talk to him. You know, Senator Sam Brownback has been very involved in opposing rights for gays and lesbians and various homosexual issues. And so I just wanted to talk to him about that. I didn't go in to fight him. I said, Senator Brownback, let's talk about the various biblical verses, on which you base your point of view, and I'd done my research and gone back to my Bible and was reading this, and I was shocked to discover he didn't know any of them. And I said, Brownback, I'm not challenging your views on homosexuality. I just want to know where you get them, because you don't get them from the Bible. You don't even know what the Bible says about it. And he says, oh, God just tells my heart. Well, you know how God speaks to us? He speaks to us in part through the Bible. And anyone who is going out there and saying, I represent Christianity in America, and they haven't even read the Bible, you have a problem there.
Amen to that. Well, that certainly is true. But the really fascinating the Brownback, but many of the other senators that we look to for conservative leadership, and certainly I'm a conservative and I'm a Christian, and most of what these people do seems very, very good. And yet, of course, that Senator Imhoff, apparently he's affiliated with the family as well. Is that right?
He is. And I think you'd be surprised. I think a lot of conservatives out there, as I said, I'm not a very conservative person myself. I have a lot of conservative friends. I have great respect for the personal integrity of so many honest conservatives, which is always so impressive. But then when you look at some of the leaders, you look at someone like Senator Sam Brownback or his ally in the House, Representative Joe Pitts. And Brownback and Pitts are the chairman, respectively, of the House and Senate versions of something called the Values Action Team, created by Tom DeLay back in the 90s. The Values Action Team is an off-the-record caucus of religious conservative organizations. Well, that's fine. They should have a voice in Congress. Now, what are Brownback and Pitts doing? Well, they teamed up on something called the Silk Road Act, passed in 1999, renewed in 2006. And I'll tell you what it is, and you decide if this sounds like a Christian conservative piece of legislation. They decided that what they needed to do was give U.S. aid, big, big money, to the dictators of the various Central Asian republics, the former Soviet republics that are now Central Asian independent countries, and to give them aid. Now, why would we be giving money to a dictatorial regime? Well, the ostensible excuse is, we want these guys to fight radical Islam. Well, if there's one thing we learned from Saudi Arabia, from which 19 of the 9/11 bombers came from, is that a dictatorial regime tends to foster radical Islam. What's the best antidote to radical Islam? Democracy, right? That's what we have here. That's what's best around the world. So why are these guys supporting this? Well, one of the side effects of this piece of legislation was a windfall for corporations involved with natural gas, involved with pipelines. One of those is Koch Industries, the mega power company. And Koch Industries happens to be Senator Sam Brownback's biggest financial backer. That looks pretty sketchy to me. That doesn't seem Christian or conservative to me. That sounds like cronyism.
Well, I think there's so much of that, but isn't that really what they do? It's all the relationships between the members of the family and other people who hold power, whether they're affiliated with the family or not. You know, it's simply one of the quotations you gave from Doug Coe, and basically was, you know, if we don't have power in this group, we're going to be a coward.
Yeah, exactly. So we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. So, for instance, an example of a place where they could work with power, here's a surprising example. I was stunned to find this in the archives. Quite some time ago, before he came to power, the family identified in communist China. They were looking for politicians whom they could work with. And they found a rising star named Deng Xiaoping, who, of course, went on to become the premier of China and was the man who responsible for the Tiananmen anti-democracy massacre. They liked Deng. Deng Xiaoping was their kind of guy. They sent over a delegation of congressmen. Deng Xiaoping's star rose in part because he became known within China as the man who could negotiate with the Americans. But he wasn't really negotiating with the Americans, was he? He was negotiating with the family. That's the kind of sort of network that they're going for there.
And I think for our listeners out there, you remember, of course, the Tiananmen Square massacre. And what was America's response? Of course, people were saying, we ought to cut off relationships with China. No, we gave them most favored nation trade status to reward them for Tiananmen Square. And there's no other.
It's great. And let's remember, both Democrats and Republicans participated in that. And that's one of the lessons that we really learned from, I think, from the family. And it's a lesson for both conservatives and liberals, is that we don't want to get ourselves too closely aligned with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. We don't even need to think entirely in terms of conservative or liberal. Let's think in terms of democracy versus empire. And I think there's a lot of conservatives and a lot of liberals all on the side of democracy. And there's a few elites over there on the side of empire. Their interests are butted by that, not ours. Giving China most favored trading partner status, whose interest was that in? It wasn't in the regular Chinese people's interest. It wasn't in my interest. It wasn't in your interest. Who benefited from that?
And I think this is what people really have to understand. There are these forces out there which are little known to the average individual. And when you go to the polls, you think you're voting for the candidate of your choice. You're not. You're voting for the candidate usually of their choice, and so often they control both political parties. They control both candidates. So you can pick whichever one you want to, but they always come out on top. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment. Now, our guest this evening is Jeff, and his last name is Charlotte. And, of course, the book is The Family. We're going to be carrying it. We think it's a very important book, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, Jeff, do you actually have a website? Anything, information you'd like to get out to our listeners?
Well, the main information I want to get out there is go pick up a copy of The Family. I have to say, I feel almost evangelistic about this book. If people can't afford it, go buy the used copy. I'm not going to get any proceeds from that, but I do want this story to get into the mainstream. And one of the things I would ask your listeners, Dr. Stan, is I want to get conservatives talking about this. I first wrote about the family for a liberal magazine called Harper's, and I've always said, if I'd had my choice of the place to publish it, the place that would have made sense, I would have published in the evangelical magazine Christianity Today. This is where the real fight is going to happen. Liberals can do part of that fight, but the real fight against this kind of imperialistic, power-worshipping, anti-Christian religion under the guise of Christianity has got to take place within the American Christian community. So it's up to your listeners to take this fight and blog about it and investigate, do their own investigations and pursue it out there. And I think that's the best chance we have of making a real challenge to this group. So that's my pitch. Go get the book and then use it to do your own investigation.
And I think one of the most shocking things to me when I first heard about this was they were putting on the presidential prayer breakfast. I mean, this has been around ever since I can remember, going back decades, and everybody always assumed this was, it had to do with the president and had to do with evangelical Christianity, and yet it absolutely nothing to do with either one of them.
Yeah, one of the stories I tell in the book is the creation of the National Prayer Breakfast in 1953. They had been trying to get President Truman to do it, and he said, absolutely not. Although Truman, it's forgotten, was religiously a fairly conservative Christian. Eisenhower was elected. They said, Eisenhower, we want you to do this. Eisenhower said, no way. He said, this is a violation of the First Amendment. This is disrespectful to religious freedom in America. But because one of the leaders of the family, Senator Frank Carlson, had done a lot of political favors for Eisenhower. He called in his chits, and Eisenhower said, okay, I'm going to go just this once. And he went just that once. For the rest of his administration, he was represented by Vice President Richard Nixon, who, not a great religious believer himself, but he sure did see the political utility of this project. And that's that just kind of absolute cynicism that makes a mockery of Christianity and American values. That's the legacy of the National Prayer Breakfast. Goes on to this day, reported every year as if it's not a very important story. You can see it on C-SPAN But what C-SPAN can't cover, they only cover 3 hours of it, is it's a week-long event, mostly with foreign delegations, foreign heads of state who are using this to win access to American power.
We're out of time, Jeff.
American corporations.
Well, I guess it's been Jeff Charlotte and those duties. So fascinating. I almost missed my cue there. Hey, thank you so very much for being with us, Jeff. I do
thank
want to get you,
you
on to our other networks. We actually do 4 different networks. We have a fair outreach across America. But thank you very much for doing your research, for doing your homework, for writing the book. I think it's very important. I hope our listeners will want to get your book and will want to understand that there are forces behind the scenes which most people have no idea of. God bless and thanks so much.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the book, and we will be carrying the book. It's called The Family. Now, certainly for the people who say, well, there could not be something like this going on. Why, the presidential prayer breakfast, that's put on by the president? I mean, you think that the Barbara Bush is out there cooking breakfast? Of course not. Of course, this is put on by a group you've never even heard of, but it's all about power. And, of course, as I read the book, I see this influence of the New World Order, the New World Religion, and, of course, the ultimate establishment of a one-world leader. And, of course, the organization was created by a man who had a revelation from God that Christianity was all wrong, and now we're going to have a new form of religion. But we're not even going to necessarily call us, you know, Christians. We're just going to be followers of Jesus, whatever that means. But it's a different Jesus, a Jesus dedicated to power. A very important book, and I hope you'll want to give us a call. Don't call into our exchange until a few minutes after the hour, because I've got to call them and let them know we're going to be carrying this book. And then, because this fits in with my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, if you haven't read it, shame on you. You need to get it or see the DVD. But you maybe want to get the book and the DVD and the tape and the Brotherhood of Darkness special, because it is the first introduction to many people to the forces that really rule the world. And then, of course, our talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus. That's the forbidden secret, if there is a secret, been passed down for 5,000 years. And there really are forces out there that can influence people and come to control their lives. And certainly you want to get our material on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that, because we give you some of the material actually written by the people on the other side, where they will tell you how their people are in everything. And if you want to get anything we've offered today, just ask for the Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. It's put out by a Luciferian organization, the Lucius Trust, and they will tell you about the hierarchy of people, of these beings they have actually planted all throughout the world. I mean, this is not what I say. This is what they say. Could this really be what's going on? Is there some sort of an organized effort to create a financial crisis in America, to destroy the value of our currency, to impoverish our people, to enslave our people? You really need, of course, to get our 4 tape set on the oil deception. That's the oil deception. And, of course, if you don't believe that these forces working in the world, you need to get the Economic Hitman. It's a 4-tape or 4-CD set, the Economic Hitman, written by a man who had actually been recruited into the National Security Agency and then sent out to actually help take over countries throughout the world. And, of course, they weren't successful. They sent in the assassins and have them killed. And he talks openly about the assassination of world leaders that he had worked with. And then we have the 4-tape set, The Economic Hitman. We actually have another book written by John Perkins. His first book, entitled The Confessions of Economic Hitman, is out of print, although you may be able to get it on Amazon. His second book, The Secret History of the American Empire. And that's what it's all about. You didn't know that we have troop station in 130 nations. Why would we have troop station in 130 nations? Why is President Bush insisting that the Iraqis allow us to have something like 58 bases and to stay in Iraq indefinitely? And the Iraqis don't want us there. They've asked us to leave. But, of course, we want to keep our troops there, as we have our troops today in Germany, as we have our troops today in Japan, as we have our troops today in South Korea. Or occupying all those countries, but we can't let you common people understand this, because, of course, you wouldn't understand that there's a higher goal, a goal, of course, to bring about a new world order, a new world religion. and, of course, a new world leader. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.